What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of 2 clinically studied ingredients in 1 revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school, you're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
It's 11:39 p.m. at Synanon, and you're listening to Night Call. Hello, and welcome back to Night Call, a call-in show for our dystopian reality. I am Tess Lynch, and with me are
Molly Lambert and
Emily Yoshida.
Hey, guys.
Hello. And later in the show, we're going to be joined by Robert Evans, host of Behind the Bastards, and citizen journalist, to tell us all about being a live streamer in these crazy times.
We thought we would jump in real quick with an email from Meg. She writes, "Hello, Night Call. Wasn't sure if you've seen the online petition going around demanding that Splash Mountain be rethemed to Princess and the Frog. I work in the theme park industry here in Orlando, and usually when updating a classic ride comes up, there are many decries from theme park enthusiasts and Disney purists that this is erasing history and the ride should be used as a teaching moment. Same argument came up with the retheming of the bride auction scene in Pirates of the Caribbean. While I agree with what Karina Longworth recently tweeted about films like Song of the South and Gone with the Wind, where decirculating these films can turn them into fetish objects, I'm not sure this applies to theme park rides. While it's nice to think that parents would use problematic aspects of rides as a teaching moment for their children, I believe it's not the case the majority of the time. Theme park rides feature simple story narratives that can be easily consumed in less than 10 minutes. And while I appreciate the museum-esque aspects of some Disney attractions, mostly at Epcot or the Everest Queue in Animal Kingdom, the reality is people don't linger and ponder these galleries in theme parks. They rush past them as it is another box to be checked on the to-do list of things to cram in on their vacation. I feel that theme park rides are more like Confederate statues, in that it subconsciously communicates the kind of ideas, stories, morals of history we uphold as worthy of celebration. Would love to hear your thoughts. Thank you for keeping me company every week. Just watched Eyes Without a Face last week and loved it. Thank you, Meg. What do you guys think?
Thanks, Meg.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, my first thought in reading this email was just like, Okay, like yes, a ride that was created in 1990 to celebrate Song of the South, which is like not even available to like watch legally, is insane. And it's insane that that was made in 1990. If you go to Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, that's like kind of the shadow most offensive thing in Disneyland. And it's like, that's one of those things that's truly like embraced by the Disneyland heads where they're like, you can't mess with that. That's classic Disneyland. But it's so fucked up. It's crazy.
I feel like there are, that's the thing too. It's like there are other even more fucked up rides still in Disneyland.
Yeah.
The Jungle Cruise is more openly racist than Splash Mountain because Splash Mountain is like so divorced from the source material that unless you knew it was a Song of the South ride, you would never know that.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this when we had Karina on before she did her Song of the South series on You Must Be Remember This, which is great. Highly recommend it if you haven't listened to that yet. But because it is like, for me, a 90s kid or whatever, I went on Splash Mountain, you know, during our vacation to California when I was like 5. And there was songs from Song of the South on Disney sing-along tapes. And there's like weirdly the thing lives on in a way. I think that they're just different kinds of insidious. That's more just like a...
For sure.
We're not going to let this go, even though we're going to like make the source material mysteriously unavailable, but we're going to like honor it in quotes somehow.
Well, there's a lot of like antebellum South fetishization
totally.
In Disneyland.
For sure.
Also, because that's like Walt's whole bit, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
So I think it's very baked into all theme parks, that kind of imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, there's like kind of that antebellum architecture in a lot of like there's a theme park I grew up going to a lot in Kansas City called Worlds of Fun. I'm sure that people who listen from Kansas City will have thoughts about Worlds of Fun if they've been there. But I feel like there is a lot of that was like an international themed one. But I swear that there was like a bunch of like the genteel old South type stuff in there, too, just because it's like Kansas. But yeah, I would say like I'm all for I don't think that theme parks should necessarily be treated as museums. And like
no.
if Disneyland wanted to make a museum where they like put their shuttered stuff, I think that would actually be really valuable, but they will never do anything that's that self-reflexive or like self-critical.
Right.
For sure. They don't want us to talk about it, but definitely some of like, there are just other little weird racist Easter eggs all over Disneyland because they like never get rid of anything too.
Yeah.
So there was like a Native American village that took up most
oh,
of
yeah.
Frontierland when it opened. But there are like animatronics from that on the Mark Twain cruise. Like I had never actually gone around the river until I did once. And I was like, oh, there's all these like repurposed Native American animatronics that I did not know
yeah.
were still in Disneyland. But it's that Disney, it's that, like Karina talks about on her podcast, it's that sort of paternalist, like here's history from
yeah.
the point of view of a fucked
right.
up old racist white guy. Telling yeah. you what history was like.
I agree with what you guys are saying, but I do have one question about Meg's email, which is why would the Princess and the Frog be
oh,
the reinvented
it's perfect.
Thing?
It's perfect.
Not interesting to me. It's not compelling. I really liked the Moana idea, and I was into the Zootopia idea. Zootopia should be an entire land anyway.
Here's why it has to be the Princess and the Frog. Because...
Okay.
It's next to New Orleans Square. That
yeah.
whole area is already New Orleans themed. The
yeah.
Haunted Mansion, the little fake Bourbon Street area, and the Pirates
the
of the Caribbean.
The only good restaurant.
The
oh,
Blue
yeah.
Bayou.
Yeah.
The
I
bread
mean, it's
bowl.
Not good, but
the
yeah.
gumbo in a bread bowl. All that stuff is kind of New Orleans themed. And then you go over to like Critter Country. It's more just like ambiguously Southern themed. But Princess and the Frog is New Orleans.
Critter Country is like Appalachia. And New Orleans is more the South. It's like you
yeah.
get a brief tour of the Eastern United States between Main Street USA and there.
But is there enough like water in The Princess and the Frog?
Yeah, it takes place in
I don't remember anything about the Princess.
Also, the good thing
swamp.
About Princess and the Frog, like, and I can't remember from the last time I went to Disneyland how much of a presence it has in New Orleans, in the New Orleans part of the park, because if it doesn't, that's also fucked up, because it like felt like it was tailor-made to be slotted into that part of the Disney Parks experience, because it's like very like voodoo and like, I don't know, like there's tons of music and it's all like very...
The villain from that movie, who is a great villain, he appears in the Halloween parade that they just announced they are not doing this year because of COVID. But I did just also get an ad for Orlando, for Universal Orlando reopening like 1 second before we started recording. And it was an ad that showed them like wiping down escalators and like...
Fun for the whole family.
I roll my eyes so hard when we talk about that stuff on this podcast. I feel like it's audible. I've been getting a lot of ads for casinos, and in the same vein of like, it's been too long. It's been too long.
It has to be Princess and the Frog, because... it's the first black princess in Disney history.
Yeah, it's only right.
I had no idea. I saw the Princess and the Frog, and I was like, I don't have like any grasp.
I thought
of
it was
Princess
cute.
And the Frog.
It was like, it's got like, it's very music driven, as I recall. I think I saw it like whenever it came out, which makes it good for Splash Mountain, because Splash Mountain ends with like a big kind of musical performance, so it's like very easy to drop in all the animatronics.
Splash Mountain already
animals.
Has a riverboat. Like, there's just a lot of things you could easily adapt to New Orleans. The thing that people really didn't like about the Princess and the Frog is that it gives you this black princess Tiana, and then it turns her into a frog for the whole movie.
Yeah.
Oh shit! This is the I'm sorry. I shouldn't say shit and then talk about the children's movie. It's like I'm conditioned to correct myself there.
No,
but
it's okay.
I know I have a Tiana fan in my house, but we have never watched. But now that I guess we have Disney Plus, we can. I was thinking it was like an old timey thing.
I love at this point you can just like be a fan of Tiana and never having seen Princess and the Frog, because that's just like Disney Princesses is its whole separate like machine.
It's weird, the like weird sieve of information. It's the same with LOL Surprise Dolls. Like I don't know what they are, but I can recognize them.
There was an LOL Surprise controversy. The LOL Surprise guy just got canceled because he ripped off...
LOL Surprise sounds like something that was like destined to get canceled. I don't even know what it
LOL
is.
LOL Surprise, you're canceled.
It's like a big ball full of toys. That's the surprise. It's like a plastic ball, and you open it, it's full of toys.
But the dolls inside, there was a controversy too. Maybe I'm mixing it up, but I think that in a parenting group that I'm in, there was a controversy where the LOL Surprise dolls were like dressed very like as if they had just come out of like a sex dungeon or something, and it was like LOL Surprise, you don't get to choose which dolls you get. And it didn't really go well. But I'll fact check this for our show notes.
Okay, so LOL Surprise introduced a doll called the Rainbow Raver that is an exact like replica of this girl who's an influencer whose name is Amina Mucciolo, who Bratz and Mattel, I think, also... She's been ripped off before. But basically they made a doll of her. She's like, her whole thing is like Rainbow Raver, and she has like blue hair with like, if you look at the doll and you look at her, you're like, yes, this is definitely like a ripoff of this specific person.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So she called them out on it online. And then the guy who is the CEO of LOL Surprise, like tweeted a bunch of racist shit back at her.
What? Oof.
And everybody was like, hey, you know this is public and we can all see you, right? So,
jeez, Louise.
Yeah. So he was like, denied all culpability and said some racist stuff to her. So LOL Surprise canceled.
I will happily cancel. Yeah, you canceled.
What Disneyland rides would you guys retheme and how?
Oh, man. I'm trying to think of ones I don't. Well, this is just a personal preference. I really don't like the teacups ride at this point. I've noticed at some point becoming dizzy was like the worst experience for me. And I got on the teacups last time and I almost had to like emergency get off and spew because I just couldn't deal with the dizzy. So I'm like, is there a way? And the Dumbo rides, it's like the ones that I loved as a child, maybe I just want other children to not experience the joy I had and rob
See,
them of
I
that.
I think the teacups are one of the few things that I feel like are ironclad. Like they're never, like they're so timeless, and they're like, I get so happy whenever I see the teacups because the design is so perfect and they keep them so fucking clean that it's like.
They have to because people throw up on the teacups.
I'm sure. Like, I'm sure they get wiped down even pre-COVID, like yeah. every hour. But like, and there's like nothing, there's no like creatures in it besides like the Cheshire Cat. It's just like those cute little lanterns and stuff. And it's just like, it's great. It's like peak Disney aesthetic, I feel
right.
like.
Right. Well, that's the thing, right? Is Disney is all about like wiping away the sharp corners of history to make it just like...
What was really going on at yeah. that tea party?
Just the antiseptic, you know, world.
Yeah. I mean, I would the one that bums me out the most right now, and it is a recently made over one, is the how they redid 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea to be Finding Nemo.
Oh, totally. I changed my answer to that.
Yeah.
It's awful. It's so depressing, too, because you can't help but remember when you, like, descend the stairs into the submarine how it used to be. And it's mm-hmm. so, like, it's like, who wants to watch a TV underwater?
That's what's funny is, like, yeah. we all care so much more about that than about a potential Splash Mountain retheming. Like, Splash Mountain, I'm like, even though we are all of the Splash Mountain generation, like... Make it the Princess and the Frog. I don't care. Like, yeah, that would yeah. be better for the kids.
But yeah. it still has to have the drop.
It's the same ride.
It's the same ride. Okay. That was my other... I was like, we have to think of something where there's, like, a wet drop.
The ride tech, it's like you can build in any narrative excuse for a wet drop. Like, that's, like, yeah. the Jurassic Park ride thing. It's like, when is there a wet drop in Jurassic Park? And yet, they managed to make one of the best wet drops of all time. I love saying wet drop.
I know. Did we just coin it?
Have you guys seen all the Jurassic Park... tweets that have been going around where everybody's like, remember when we thought it was unrealistic that they would reopen the park immediately after people died?
I am not, but again, yeah.
Oof. They yeah. were like, that was the plot hole. Everybody was like, why would they like just open it for people to come die? Who would go to a park like that? It's like,
Because of freedom, and everybody should be free to get eaten by a dinosaur if that's what they mm-hmm. want. That's your own personal liberty.
Should we take a break and come back with a night call?
Let's do it.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Hi, Nightfall. I'm not sure if this is going to work in terms of the math and the calendar of when podcasts were produced versus now, but in the most recent episode where you guys talked about California split, you mentioned Synanon, which is a fascinating organization, and they owned this luxury hotel in Santa Monica for a long time. But then in the late 70s, they kind of collapsed after there was a lot of criminal activity that they were involved in, including putting a rattlesnake in the mailbox of an attorney who had brought suit against them. But anyway, there's all kinds of weird culty stuff that they did that has had a lot of influence in behavior modification still to this day. So anyway, might be something you guys would be interested into diving in deeper. Thanks. Bye.
Such a good night call. I am fascinated by Synanon.
Yeah. I think I had read about them before and then I didn't put it together when, you know, they're credited at the end of California Split. Because it's like one of those names like Esalen that just kind of sounds like nothing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Super, super interesting though.
Yeah. I think I heard about Synanon from a friend of my mom's actually. He was like, have you ever looked into Synanon? It's fascinating. Because I didn't know. I sort of knew, I'd heard the name before, but I think I got it confused with Narcanon, which is the Scientology.
Yeah.
Narcotics yeah. Anonymous. But
Narcus Anonymous.
Well, there's Al-Anon, which yeah. is like friends of AA. There's just a lot of Anons to. Mm-hmm.
Al-Anon's legit.
Yeah, Al-Anon's legit.
Of course.
Yeah.
Some of these are legit and some are not. Synanon was a drug rehab program that was founded by this guy named Chuck Dederick in 1958 in Santa Monica. And it started as rehab and then it kind of became more of like a probing, like, who am I thing. And then it became a cult. Basically,
it always had. Well, it was the whole thing was that it was the first drug rehab with no doctors involved.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first like self-help drug rehab. And Chuck Dederick came up with it apparently after taking acid. He was like, we should look inside. And it was founded like a few years before Esalen, but some of the group games and stuff are very similar to Esalen. It's just like, getting past your hangups to like what's really underneath inside, and we're gonna
and
get
a lot
you.
Of like uncensored talking, like we're gonna get right after it, we're gonna talk about
again,
it
again, just like very similar to acting exercises.
Oh, totally,
very similar.
The Kaminsky
to like,
method,
yeah. Well, mm-hmm. like the whole master thing, you know, the little walking back and forth between the walls and slapping them type
yeah.
stuff, you know.
Oh, for sure,
fun with your friends.
So they yep. played a game that was called The Game.
Ooh,
that sounds very scary, where you, like, get people all up in their insecurities.
Oh, I used to play this in high school. actually, I did, like, total sidebar. There was a thing called The Game. Did you ever know about this around that time? That's just, like, The Game. You're always playing The Game until you think of The Game, and then you've lost The Game, and then you have to say, I lost The Game.
Vaguely yeah, kind of. Remember this.
It's one of those, like, kind of stonery high school things. But anyway, I've also done probably the other game as well.
More familiar with the one where you like make a hand sign and try to get your friend to look at it, and then
oh,
you're
yeah.
like, you lost the game when they do.
Oh, I don't know
you
that.
Like, you go like this, but like down by your knee, and then you can see what I'm doing on a podcast in your mind.
Okay, well, back to Synanon. It also became a church, Molly, you mentioned at some point.
Yeah, well, they became, so they basically filed for church status. They like incorporated into a company. It was like this guy had a storefront in Santa Monica, and then they moved into some old army barracks on the beach. And then they ended up making enough money to buy a hotel called the Club Casa del Mar, which I think became Shutters, maybe?
Oh, really?
Yeah. But they turned it into dorms. And it was sort of like a commune as well. It was like anyone could join. You didn't have to be in recovery. But you had to go totally cold turkey off drugs, and you had to cut off contact with everybody from the outside world for 3 months, which is very culty. And after a few years, it was originally supposed to be a 2-year inpatient program, and then you get out. But at some point, Chuck decided that there was no, like, once you're an addict, you never really recover, so you can never really leave Synanon.
It's the Hotel California.
So then it just kind of morphed into a cult, and they all shaved their heads.
Yeah, they shaved their heads. The married couples had to break up. They gave men vasectomies and coerced people into having abortion. It's just so crazy.
So I know, like, you mentioned that THX 1138, George Lucas's first feature, used extras from it. But, like, that just makes it sound like it was based, like, THX 1138 was based on Synanon, because that's what THX 1138, like, nobody can have sex in it. And it's just like everybody's sort of this androgynous drone.
Well, I think people were experimenting with a lot of alternative living situations at the time. That's the thing, is like Synanon was one of so many things that were happening in the 60s. In the alternative living space, I don't think people like batted it an eye at Synanon.
Yeah.
As much as we might right now.
Well, there was, so the anecdote about the snake in the mailbox is very interesting to me. There's an LA Mag article about this by Hillel Aaron, but it's basically, there was like a journalist turned lawyer named Paul Morantz.
Yeah, I looked at his website a bunch because
he has a website too. But he had sued Synanon on behalf of this woman who claimed that she had been kidnapped and tortured and brainwashed and a bunch of horrible stuff. And Morantz won the lawsuit, so they got $300,000. And then once he realized how horrible this group was, he started pressuring the Department of Public Health to shut them down. And then he started getting, like, scary retaliatory phone calls and threats from Synanon members. So he got really paranoid because, I mean, much like people who speak out about Scientology, it just sounded like it was very oppressive to him. And one day he was like, I'm going to stop thinking about this. I feel like I've just been so paranoid. And he was chilling out watching sports on TV. And then he saw a weirdly shaped package slip through the mail slot in his door. And when he went to grab it, it was a 4.5-foot long rattlesnake that bit him on the hand. And the rattler on the tail had been removed so that it wouldn't make noise. And alert him, which is the fucking scariest thing I've ever heard. It's so bizarre. I mean, it's weird. I would have thought that this would have been on our radar from day one, but I really hadn't heard of it until California split, and then I was like, what's this?
Wow.
Well, that's what's so funny about it, was it was like right on the beach for so many years. It was like everybody knew about it because it was on the strand, and you would see the Synanon people like wandering around.
It's just so weird to think about a time when Santa Monica had, like, anything that weird in it.
Oh, God, I know. I heard the worst story yesterday about Manhattan Beach from Kate Raft was posting about it.
Worse than the Eyelash House?
Yes.
Uh-oh.
A rich white mom filed to hold a BLM march, but it was actually just a graduation march for her daughter and her friends.
And didn't they have hula hoops? I heard about this. They had hula hoops so that they could pretend like
it was an exercise class if they got caught.
Wait, so what did she had to file because they wanted to have like a gathering of more than however many people you're supposed to have.
Yes, so she said they were having a BLM march, but then it was actually just like a rich white kid graduation party. Like, we're wearing Lays while we walked around in our graduation outfits.
Oof.
Manhattan Beach is so bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like Synanon, you know, there's that the weird rehab in Inherent Vice too is totally,
yeah,
feels like Synanon to me. Thomas Pynchon lived in Manhattan Beach before it got so gentrified that nobody cool could live there. Yeah, imagine living at the beach and it being weird and scuzzy. Again, the dream.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, like the proximity of rehab to cults at that time, is it just feels like this like perfect timing, because it's like the first time that people have actually started to think about drug rehabilitation and like getting people like it, aside from like a sanitarium or something super old school, like people were actually trying to think about holistic ways of treating drug addiction.
Right. In a way, these people invented like promises, you know.
Right. Yeah.
They invented the beachside rehab, which is now like Malibu is completely overrun with these rich person rehabs. They take up like half the real estate. It's interesting, yeah, to think of that coming out as something as scuzzy and actually counterculture-y as Synanon. I watched Spaceship Earth, which I recommend so much, because it's about the biosphere, but I had no idea it was about how the biosphere came out of a commune and out of like a weird intentional community that is headed by a guy whose name is Dolphin Johnny.
Nice.
But you know, he's friends with Buckminster Fuller, like it's all legit, but it's sort of the good version of this where everybody's like, yeah, nothing bad happened. We just sailed around the world on a ship we built ourselves.
That's the dream.
And they're like also an experimental theater company.
Of course. It's really not be eventually. I mean, that's why I'm like, I feel like the odds of a rehab commune or something turning into an experimental theater company are just
so high
as becoming a cult. It's just we only hear about the cults.
Right. One thing I did learn about Synanon that I didn't know is that allegedly they morphed into the wilderness retreat rehab thing that super rich kids in LA do.
Is that the one where you get snatched out of your bed in the middle of the night?
Uh-huh. Ha! It's a whole mini industry that's like for kids who do too many drugs, their parents pay to like have them sent away to do like a, yeah, like a,
they do like a blackout
trip
experience type thing. Like
pretty much, yeah.
Like an escape room, like a turbo escape room.
A turbo escape room in the woods. It's like they leave you in the woods with materials and you have to like find your way back. People have died on them. There have been kids who have died, yeah, from heat
there
exposure.
There was an expose a few years ago about these that was so hard to read. It's so cruel.
I think I was totally like, who runs these? And finding out it's like, that's what Synanon turned into. Creepy, but also makes sense.
Terrible. Boo. Cancel Synanon too. Well, guys, should we take a break before we have our guest Robert Evans join us?
Yeah, let's.
Great.
Let's do it.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more.
Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Welcome back to Night Call. We are thrilled to be joined today by our guest, Robert Evans, the only Robert Evans. Robert is the host of Behind the Bastards, also on iHeartRadio, and Behind the Police, the new spinoff. He's also the author of A Brief History of Vice and is an investigative journalist at Bellingcat. Welcome, Robert, to Night Call.
Thank you for having me.
We've all been on Behind the Bastards at certain points. So now you're in our turf. You're on the other side of the tracks.
The shit just got reciprocal.
We wanted to talk to you a little bit today about sort of the citizen journalism aspect of the recent protests and uprisings.
Yeah.
And then take some listener questions.
Yeah.
That are specifically for our guest, Robert.
We got a ton of good ones, too. So you better have all the answers.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I'll do my
about
best.
About how to defeat fascism, et cetera. We're going to figure that out.
Robert, you've been reporting live from the Pacific Northwest during the past month and before that. And you are very much on the front lines of the stuff, both online and offline. So we just wanted to talk to you a little bit about your experiences doing that.
Yeah, you know, I got bored during the lockdown of, you know, exercising in my front yard and going on jogs. So like dodging police munitions was a nice change in calisthenics for a couple of weeks. So yeah, it was mostly just like a keeping my heart rate up sort of thing, you know?
Just making sure you're still in shape.
Yeah, exactly.
Still ready for the next track meet.
Think of a riot line armed with grenade launchers as a kind of gym. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you were the first person I saw reporting about some of the stuff that has now been reported in the mainstream, specifically the Boogaloo stuff.
Yeah.
You were the first person I saw tweeting about that and saying...
Jason Wilson and I of The Guardian put together a big article on that, yeah.
Yeah, and that was, you know, I just noticed a lot, and I've noticed this with all the you know, uprisings of the past few years, that there is just such a huge divide between the way it's reported online and the way it's reported on television and in newspapers, that it feels like generationally we're getting a completely different sets of news.
Yeah, and completely different sets of realities. And on the right, to a lesser extent on the left, but on the right, a really organized ecosystem dedicated to making sure that there are two fundamentally separate realities. And that is why one chunk of the country believes Antifa, who has never been tied to a single murder, is a terrorist organization, while the domestic terrorists responsible for 90% of the domestic terror attacks over the last 6 months, which are right-wing domestic terrorists, aren't a problem. Like, it's because the world they live in is fundamentally different because there was a concerted media effort to make sure that that was the case.
How culpable is Mark Zuckerberg for all of this?
Pretty culpable. Not for the, I mean, obviously the actual problem of like siloing off the right wing to a separate reality started way before Mark Zuckerberg. And I don't think he was an intentional part of that. I think the thing that Mark Zuckerberg deserves blame for is Facebook developed a system whereby they would recommend Facebook groups to people, which were closed and siloed off from the rest of the world, and acted as like radicalization chambers for people. And most of the time when people joined, even like particularly the groups for Facebook's internal numbers suggested that 64% of the time when people joined the Facebook group for an extremist organization like the KKK or the Proud Boys, 64% of the time, it was because Facebook's algorithm had recommended that group to them. And Zuckerberg was one of a number of people at Facebook who were like, this isn't a problem. Let's keep doing it. It makes us money. And like, that's, you know, we could also talk about the ethnic cleansings Facebook is partly culpable in, but there's a long list of reasons they suck.
It's really ironic, I think, because like, I feel like Facebook's in general, I mean, everybody's still on Facebook. Like, it's the most mainstream thing in the world, but like, it did have a dip in public trust, I feel like, in the last couple of years, or at least since Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
But then they like poured all this money into advertising in the last year or so, and it's all been based on groups. Like, all of their advertising campaigns have been like, Facebook groups is the reason to be on Facebook. And it's just like, but that's actually one of the most problematic parts of it right now. They just make it seem like it's all like cat enthusiasts and stuff.
Yes. Yes.
Well, now it's like just clueless suburban people is their audience, right? That's like a lot of these websites. They are just, it's like what local news used to do, where it just like exists to stoke fear.
Yeah. Your aunt who is a very nice person and thinks Black Lives Matter is planning to break into her house and do violence to her because she's white. Like, it's because like that's the target audience for Facebook.
Yeah. And like still refers to what's been going on now for 3 weeks as the riots.
Yeah. Like, yes.
I mean, I saw some metric that was like the top 10 posts on Facebook over the past few weeks. And it is all like Ben Shapiro and Trump.
Oh, Ben.
Mm-hmm. And that's consistent too. I mean, that isn't that kind of usually the top 10 trending topics on Facebook? There's a big right-wing contingent. But it's also weird. Do you guys notice that pretty recently on Instagram, I don't think it was always there. At the bottom, it says like brought to you by Facebook.
Oh, Zuckerberg insisted on that personally. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, that's kind of interesting because like it's hard to like avoid all of those
Robert,
things for
sure. Robert, do we have to divest from all these social media companies?
Yeah, help.
It is not dissimilar from like, you know, I'm one of those people who has been suggesting, you know, as cautiously as I can, folks who have the mental space and feel safe, you know, mentally owning a firearm should maybe consider it, because it's not great that those are all concentrated in the hands of one group of very hostile people right now. And there are some problematic aspects to purchasing firearms, because not all firearms companies, but an awful lot of them are part of this horrible culture war we're in because of the kind of ads that they support and the organizations that they donate money to. But at the same time, when someone is trying to kill you with a gun, there's nothing replaces having a gun. And in the same way, when you are trying to impact the culture and change it and shift it in more positive directions, there's really nothing that replaces Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, right?
But we're admitting Twitter's a gun, right?
It absolutely is. It absolutely
is. 100%. I buy into this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Twitter and Facebook are both guns. Facebook is a gun that regularly explodes in your hand.
Is being blue check as bad as having a license?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how deep I want to get into the comparison. Like, I mean, I think Twitter and Facebook both have the potential to kill a lot more people than AR-15s do. That's about 300-400 people a year in the United States. And I think it's actually very likely that Facebook kills more people a year already than AR-15s.
I just have to be the voice on the podcast that says, I don't think people should get guns. I respect what you're saying completely, but I mean, so many people are killed by their own guns.
Absolutely.
That I don't know. I'm not there yet, but
it's a long conversation that can be had.
Yes.
And I don't feel the need to like to argue the point excessively. But yeah.
We all agree who shouldn't have guns and that those are the people who tend to have the most guns.
That's true.
Yes, and that includes the police.
Right. That is one of the problems.
Yeah.
So we wanted to talk about like citizen journalism in general, which is taking place on all these platforms, like taking place on Facebook Live and Instagram and Twitter. And I mean, I've mostly just been aware of it because I haven't been super plugged into it until like recent years. Like, it really feels like it's a completely different animal now that you have these live streaming capabilities that are on all these sites. Like, I mean, I remember like the first Periscope I ever watched and it being like, oh, is this the future of how we're going to get information? And has that been like, are there pluses and minuses to that aside from being on these platforms that are inherently problematic?
Yeah. You know, one of the minuses to kind of live streaming citizen journalism, the thing that is always on my mind when I'm working these events is that, it's not impossible that your footage will catch someone committing something that is against the law, mm-hmm. but not necessarily immoral, and that they will get in legal trouble and maybe even go to jail as a result of your recording. Now, so that's something that's always in my mind. It's part of why I try not to film and have increasingly throughout my time in the streets tried to avoid filming protesters. Sometimes it's necessary, like when protesters clash with police and police use violence on them, you have to record protesters and police. And I do think that the kind of risks for the protesters are outweighed by the massive public interest value of knowing what the police are doing when they're physically violent with protesters. I think that even the overall safety benefit to the protesters is higher, although it's not without a risk. That is something you have to consider when you're doing this sort of work. And so you have to act consciously to minimize the damage that your reporting could do and maximize the security that it will add to the public. Because at the end of the day, journalism is fundamentally about comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And you don't want to afflict the already afflicted.
Yeah. No, I feel like there's been so much more awareness, especially in this most recent wave of protests and activism, of really being aware of not seeing, like not showing protesters' face, people who are doing vandalism or anything like that. I feel like people have really, really gotten that message, especially since so many people who were involved in the Ferguson protests and other protests and after, you know, since then have been, you know, suddenly murdered mysteriously or wound up dead. Like there's a real threat there. And it's all not always just getting arrested, you know, it's lots of other stuff.
Yeah, I definitely noticed this time also just because the coverage, especially in LA, was so out of tune with what was actually happening that it was such a different world on Twitter than it was in the LA Times, for example, mm-hmm. which is the only newspaper left in LA, really. So, just there was a lot of viral videos of police brutality and of police assaulting protesters that were all taken by amateurs, you know, or citizen journalists. And it took a few days for those to reach sort of your average newspaper reader. You know, I sent my parents a few clips of things to be like, here's what's going around with people that I know that, you know, shows the police are tear gassing people, even if they say they aren't. There was a clip in Van Nuys, when Van Nuys was being looted, there was some shop owners who called the cops, and when the cops arrived, they tried to arrest the shop owners because they were black.
Yep.
That was on, like, the local news. That was, like, on the Fox affiliate. That wasn't even on, like, Unicorn Riot. That was somebody who... Like, because the reporter was flagging down the cops.
Right. Like, once it started happening, they were just sending people to kind of, like, capture it on the scene. And then you would see just there were some people who were just completely still trying to be in denial, even though it was happening, like, literally right in front of them.
Yeah.
You know, who were like, I just got tear gassed, but, like, I'm sure the protesters threw a water bottle or something.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, assault water bottles are a real danger to armored police officers. You know, one thing I do think about a lot is the continuum of force. And the continuum of force is sort of when you're thinking about what is legally allowed in self-defense, what you can do in response to someone else's aggression. Because I carry a gun pretty much every day of my life. I was actually in a situation in the streets recently where a young, like, right-wing counter-protester, like, pulled a machete and was, like, threatening marchers with it. And there was, and it was the situation where I was like, okay, she's 5-6 feet away. She's not stabbing anybody. What is the point at which I'll have to shoot her? Because there was a point if she had attempted to stab people to death, that would have been my moral obligation. And it's because lethal force does justify the use of lethal force. And so when I think about the continuum of force, I think about what are the police doing in response to what? And usually it is someone chucks water bottles and the police fire grenades wildly into a crowd. And were I to respond in a similar way to, like, say somebody were to throw a water bottle at me and I were to shoot them or stab them or even punch them, I would go to jail. And yeah. I should go to jail for that, because that would be a wild escalation of force.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's also, like, there's no consequences in place. So, you know, we've seen this happening in every city, that people are like, oh, it turns out that all of the district attorneys are, like, in the pockets of these police unions. Yeah. And that's why they're not prosecuting any of these killer cops. And that's why the killer cops have no fear of always escalating in every situation. But it was sort of amazing to see, like, the cops are accused of not de-escalating enough, and everybody, just like every police force in the country, immediately just like escalated to military vehicles.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. yeah, just demonstrating the point.
Right. Well,
and even, you know, people talk about militarized police. If they were militarized in the way that our own military is, we might be seeing less violence from them, because while our military has done some really fucked up shit in Iraq and Afghanistan, I know a lot of guys who were over there and who would deal with stuff like kids, you know, slingshotting rocks at them. And they weren't allowed to shoot those kids.
Of course.
Because yeah. that would be a violation of their rules of engagement.
Well, I think like, all of these people think they're exercising restraint by, like, yeah. just shooting people in the face with rubber bullets instead yes. of, like, shooting yeah. them, you know. And then you even saw, like, yeah. when Joe Biden was like, oh, just shoot them in the leg. It's like,
yes, Jesus fucking Christ.
What the hell, man?
That's not it.
No, just yeah. don't shoot them. And
I mean,
you like, know, you know, people have arteries in their legs, Joe.
Like, yeah, but it does feel like the veil has been pulled off for a lot of people who maybe otherwise did trust in the police or didn't think about the way the police act around communities of color and, you know, in places of poverty. It feels like a lot of those people are like, oh, I cannot deny that.
Yeah.
Well, this is a question I have, actually, because I think that to a certain degree, and in another way, like, you're talking about the these levels of force. And one thing I noticed just from being out at protests, like, not in violent situations, although I was, like, kind of on the crazy day in Fairfax in LA down here. I was there kind of right before that really started to get bad. I kind of left the scene. But one thing I noticed, especially between that and then later, there were a bunch of car protests in LA. And I was just thinking about, both from watching on live streams, like, for me, as a person who's, like, often been a pedestrian and often, you know, isn't armed, seeing the amount of force, the amount of armor that was being used against these people was really striking to me, because I identified with the people who are unarmed and pedestrians.
Yeah.
But then, like, when I was in the car protest, which was, like, the least police involvement I had seen thus far, even though everybody was driving around in, like, a weapon, essentially, like, it could have gotten bad. Like, mm-hmm. there was easily a way that a car protest could go very, very bad. But it was the level of hands-offness with the cops with that. And that was still pretty early on. Like, they were still kind of cracking down on a lot of people. They were not cracking down on that. And I was just thinking about, like there's some kind of respect for a car that there isn't for an unarmed human being.
I think it's also just harder for them to assault people when they're in their cars, is the reality. And so
sure.
some of the car protests I've been at, it's like they start just saying they're going to give out tickets for honking, you know? They just find aspects of driving mm-hmm. to criminalize so that they yeah. can say, okay, if you're here and we hear you honk, you know, we're going to pull you over and cuff you. And so
I guess the thing that I was thinking about out of that, though, is just that there are some people for whom, like, being in a car, me being in a car as opposed to being a human on a street, on a sidewalk, makes me, like, more, I don't know, gives me more agency or something, or as opposed to, like, I don't know, it feels very, I just started thinking about all this stuff, because I'm like, people are seeing these videos of police brutality at protests on Facebook and stuff, and a lot of them, it's still not clicking for them. They don't see the imbalance of power there. And I don't know. I don't know what to do with that information.
I mean, there are a lot of people out there who just respect power so much that, you know, whoever has the most force, they are going
yeah.
to respect that.
You know, they respect power because they expect that it will be used in their defense.
Yes, that's it.
And yeah. I think that one of the things we've seen that has been positive, and I don't mean, there's a wrong way to take this, and I hope people don't, it's good that so many traditional liberals have gotten tear gassed and assaulted by the police over the last couple of weeks, because now they understand the reality of the problem.
For sure. And I mean, I've heard other people say that and mention Kent State and say that Kent State was very radicalizing for like white people in America, because it was like white kids on a college campus getting tear gassed instead of just, you know, civil rights yeah. protesters yeah. that had a different effect on them because they're racist.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so many people I know and people's parents who the man in Buffalo, I'm blanking on his name right now.
Oh, geez. Who got, yeah. The who older fellow who got, yeah. Jesus.
That is the one
Antifa operative.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Noted. What is his name? Michael. Like, he was like some 75-year-old guy in Buffalo. Like, and he was like, you know, a leftist or whatever, but obviously an elderly man. And that actually was a thing that a lot of people's parents in that generation, I know that, kind of flipped mm-hmm. them. They were
well,
like,
it was
okay,
also the denial of what we could see on camera, I think, was very jolting for people. Oh, he just yeah. fell. We didn't push him. I mean, it was such a microcosm of
fuck
a larger
off with
problem.
That shit. Like, we yeah. saw it. Yeah.
I but I think that the, like, you know, because being from LA, it's like when the Rodney King tape came out, there was this feeling of like, if these things are videotaped, they cannot be denied. If you see yeah. the cops beating an unarmed black man for no reason, you will have to acknowledge that they do that. And that's, you know, their objective. It's not an accident. And there were still so many people who were just like, I'm going to choose to see what I want to see, or just like, I'm going to say whatever I want to have happened in this video happened. And that's definitely still some people on the right, I feel like, at this point. Or they just like to see leftists get the shit kicked out of them.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. I think it is. You know, we talk about this on Behind the Police. Policing in America from the very beginning, before they're even like at the very start of the first police departments in this country, a big part of the desire to have them among people who weren't rich was a desire to have what historians refer to as designated vigilantes.
Right, totally.
And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's, I think, how a lot of people who are okay with the violence against left-wing demonstrators, that's what they see. These people are bad because I don't like them, and I want someone with the power of the state to physically harm them. Yeah, it's cool and good.
Well, we got a bunch of calls for you, Robert, sure. when we let everybody know on Twitter that you're going to be on the show. So do you want to get into some of those?
Yes.
So this is a text message for you, Robert. The National Alliance, a neo-Nazi group, is dropping leaflets in my city. What should I do about it?
Oh, boy. Well, there's a couple of things. One of them would be trying to identify the individuals actually putting out the leaflets, which is, you know, a mix of sort of surveillance and detective work. But ultimately, that'll be the most useful thing to do, is identify these individuals so they do have to be connected. And so any, for example, businesses connected to them have to be connected with the actions being taken, undertaken. Another thing would be counter messaging. So potentially putting out other leaflets, warning people about what the National Alliance is, its history, the terrorism that it's inspired. I do think kind of a two-part response is justified. Another thing might be informing the FBI of what's going on, because they do care more about this sort of thing than other law enforcement agencies tend to. I would put that lowest on the list of priorities. First is figuring out who the hell is responsible and publicizing that as widely as you can. Second is counter messaging. And third would be maybe giving a heads up to federal law enforcement what's happening.
Can I ask a follow up on this? Uh-huh. If you're afraid of someone retaliating against you for, you know, outing them as having done this or whatever, what kind of ways can you disseminate that information without making yourself a target?
I'm going to tell you right now. Let me look up exactly what his handle is. There's a number of us, you know, you can reach out to on nice. Twitter. But there are anti-fascist researchers who spend a lot of their lives doing this sort of work. And you should reach out to some of them. Because they have large followings already and will help you get this information out. One person to consider is Anti-Fash Gordon, like Flash Gordon, but Anti-Fash.
Nice.
Gordon is a very experienced activist with this sort of thing. He does a lot of open source intel, so he could not only disseminate the information, he can double check it to make sure you've gotten the right guy. And I know Gordon would be very happy to do that sort of, to help with something like that. Another person to maybe reach out to would be Daniel Harper. Daniel does a podcast called I Don't Speak German, which is a history, which is like histories of individuals who are like really significant within the modern fascist movement. So those would be like two people, and he's at Daniel E. Harper on Twitter. Those are two individuals I would suggest reaching out to for maybe help with that.
I feel like if I was on a college campus right now, if this was kind of stuff was going around, for example, I would like invest in a roll of stickers in like bright neon pink that just say fascist bullshit.
Yeah.
And slot them on everything. Like, I don't know.
I have a friend who lives in like a small community, and they had a similar question like this, and I had no idea how to answer it. It's really helpful to know that there are people who can help out with that, because I know that especially like in smaller areas where it's so easy to know, you know, if I post like, oh, so-and-so is doing this, or I post a picture or whatever, then you obviously these people are violent and scary. So that's really, thank you so much. That's a great service.
Yeah. And in general, if there's like a local kind of Antifa collective around you, you know, there are individual like city and state organizations, you might consider reaching out to them as well. Cause they generally have experience doing that kind of research work and disseminating that information. So yeah.
Is this where we publicly announce our affiliation with Antifa on Night Call?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone had any doubt about that.
Your membership in a terrorist organization, yes.
Yes.
Come find us.
Let's do another question. This is about emergency rations.
Hi, my name is Dominic. I'm calling with a question for Robert Evans. I have recently started to prepare food and emergency supplies, but I live in a small apartment, and I wanted to get his opinion on what is the best way to store large amounts of water in a small area with not a lot of storage?
Yeah, you know, there's no perfect answer to that. Because obviously, like, water takes up a set amount of space, right? There's no way to make water take up less space because it is water. You know, what I would recommend and what I myself do is I keep what is about a 2 week, assuming about a gallon a day, gallon and a half a day of water. I keep about a 2 week supply of water on hand. Actually, mine's more like four because I have a little bit more space in my yard, but about a 2 week supply of water. And then what you should focus on is having a mix of water purification tablets, something like I forget the name here, but one of those like ultraviolet wands that they use that you can use in the field to sterilize water, and hand pump activated water filters. You know, you can get all three and you could keep a significant amount. You could keep all three and including a significant amount of water purification tablets in a shoebox and have what would be necessary, to filter thousands of gallons of water on hand. So, you know, you can only store so much. 2 weeks is generally a good amount. Pretty much everyone has enough space for a 2 weeks storage supply of water. Get a couple of 15-gallon jugs. And then focus on being able to purify and treat water. That's a good call. That's what I would recommend. Yeah.
And just for our listeners who might not know why you might want to do such a thing, can you just fill us in?
Yeah. Think about back when the pandemic hit. And suddenly stuff like toilet paper that you've never had a problem getting before and never had to think about was hard to get. Thankfully, that was just toilet paper. And there's alternatives to toilet paper. And it's not a thing that you need to survive. Thankfully, while we did have shortages of different foodstuffs and we're still going through those, nothing that was needed for basic survival was unavailable. But also things that we never thought we wouldn't be able to get were unavailable. And that should make you realize things that you do need to survive could be made unavailable very suddenly.
Yeah, I mean, I bought a grip of water the last time there was a little earthquake because I was like, oh, I should have so much water in case there's a big earthquake. And then I have drank it all during the pandemic.
Yeah, and I'm not advocating stockpiling years worth of supplies in a bunker because I don't think that actually gets you much security. You should have enough, a 2 to 4 week supply of food and water is a good idea for everyone in this country, and it's something that you can build up over a period of time without spending a huge amount of money.
I would say especially for people who live in natural disaster prone areas, such as Los Angeles, or
you guys make me want a Xanax right now.
Well, it's, you know, the Xanax preparation is the Xanax.
Just staring at that stuff, though, I think would decrease my quality of. I'm going to do it. You've clearly scared the shit out of me. I'm going to do it. But
can I tell you something really funny? Actually, during the uprising, Sharon Stone posted this crazy like how to build a safe room thing because. Like a lot of rich white people in LA, she was afraid people were going to like come directly to her house to loot it.
Going to loot Sharon Stone. I'm going to be honest here. Yeah, we all were going to loot Sharon Stone.
You had a Santa's checklist and she was number one on
it. Well, at first I thought she was offering a safe house. And then I was like, oh no, she's saying here's how to like build a panic room. But one of the things she said was make sure you have a supply of water and Xanax.
Yeah.
Now I know why.
Yeah, and a panic room is not going to increase your safety in any meaningful way. I don't need to get into detail of what people who really wanted to harm you could do to a panic room. There's two things that will increase your safety. One is having enough of a supply of basic necessities that you don't need to panic, right? That's the goal. The goal is not to panic and buy supplies. The goal is that if something bad happens, you don't have to go out and contribute to the panic because you're like, well, no, I'm good. I have food, I have water, I have toilet paper, like I made sure that I was prepared a while ago. I can just sort of sit this out. The other aspect of true security is building ties with a community of people around you that you can rely on if things get really bad and you need to, because the only real security that exists for any of us is communal security, community security. That's the only real self-defense.
Totally. And I think we've been seeing how as people realize that maybe the networks that are supposed to protect them are actually just harmful, that you do have to build counter networks of mutual aid.
Yeah.
Luckily, we all got a weird 3-month crash course in how everybody is interconnected and needs to help each other before we really had to team up and help each other.
But look out, guys, because Facebook is going to steal all of this to further advertise for groups. They're like, even the Antifa podcasters say that community is important. See?
Yeah, use Signal.
Yeah, get on Signal. This is going to be my free spawn for Signal right now.
Yeah, your mutual aid collaborative / citizen self-defense militia.
Robert, when Trump posted a Facebook ad that had an upside-down red triangle.
Oh,
didn't he post 88 of them?
Yeah, he sure did.
Yes, he sure did.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
I didn't catch that part of it.
Was the upside down red triangle supposed to represent Antifa or anti-Antifa?
Yeah. Well, it was the upside down red triangle. The reason people flipped out rightly about that is that in Nazi Germany, when you were put in a concentration camp, your little uniform, the little jumpsuit or whatever they gave you, would have a triangle patch on it that was color-coded to why you were in the concentration camp. So, for example, homosexuals had a pink triangle. And communists, social democrats, and anarchists got a red triangle. And so when he posted a red triangle with no sort of commentary on his ad calling for violence against Antifa, a lot of people, including myself, were like, I don't think Trump knew what it meant, but I think somebody within the administration who was, you know, maybe might have been as low as an intern, who knows, but somebody who was working on the social media team knew what they were signaling.
Yeah.
And knew both that it would serve as a way for them to intimidate and frighten left-wing people, but also would serve as a way to kind of draw up like a panic among the left. And when the ads got pulled, that panic would provide full or like free advertising to the campaign. Like, I think there's probably both lines of thinking occurred in it. I do think it's as likely a statement of kind of desperation right now as it is of power, though, just because things have not been going great for the right wing in the last couple of weeks. I think they are on the back foot at the moment.
Yeah. I had a hoodie from the indie rock label Kill Rock Stars that had a yellow star on the breast, and I wore it once in front of my grandfather, who escaped from the Holocaust. And he was like, hey, I don't like that.
Yeah.
Because it reminds me of this other thing. And then I didn't wear it anymore because that made me be like, maybe you can't actually appropriate these things yet. They're always.
Yeah.
But it does seem like all sort of the greatest hits of like hateful iconography are coming back. You think that is a last gasp attempt to retain control?
Oh, we don't know. It's kind of our responsibility to ensure that it is. That's our job, is to make it be a last gasp. But that's not a guarantee.
Right.
That's a thing you have to fight to ensure.
It does feel more like gesturing. That kind of thing feels more like gesturing at power than actual power. But yeah, who knows, you know, this is a long way before the election, if we even get one. So,
yeah. It's early days yet. Anything could happen. Yep.
I'm going to hit you with another question from a listener.
Sure.
Hey, I have a question for Robert Evans. I listened to your podcast, It Could Happen Here, and I was particularly alarmed at the episode where you talked about how in certain states, like rural Americans could potentially choke the water and food supply. And I was just wondering, in your worst case Civil War scenario, is there a particular state or even a particular city you think would be a terrible, particularly terrible place to be in? Because I have a lot of friends just like looking to move out of the city in New York, and would love to tell them where to steer clear of just in case. Thanks, bye.
Was a chipper question about something very dark. Like,
yeah, there's no great place to be if things go really badly. There's aspects of living out in the country that are safer, but you're also very vulnerable to, you know, roving groups of gangs or death squads, or whatever you want to call them. There's been cases in like South America where economies have collapsed and like people who had the resources retreated to compounds in rural areas that they thought were safe. And then large groups of people would just kill them and take their stuff. And obviously there's dangers of being in a city, including the fact that a lot of cities don't have access to as much water as people think, if there's some damage to the infrastructure and food and like, but there's also a form of safety that comes from being around a lot of people who generally in cities, folks are less primed to the kind of like violent bigotry that is more common out in the middle of nowhere. So the answer is that there's no perfect place to be, and that the best thing to do is work actively to stop the shit from going down. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say some of that's already happening in places like Flint, Michigan, where the governor, Rick Snyder, who like is a total fascist, choked the water supply, like specifically to poor black parts of Michigan. And I interviewed an activist from there a couple years ago, and just hearing her talk about that and about water scarcity and like clean air scarcity becoming the big issue, it has felt to me since then like she was just sort of like speaking, you know, they're already in the future there.
I mean, things like Standing Rock too.
Right. What can people do to stop them from drilling everything and destroying everything? Are we going to have to like, you know, put ourselves in front of bulldozers in the Appalachian forest?
Yeah, sometimes. You know, obviously the that kind of work, while valuable, isn't the long-term solution. The long-term solution is fundamentally changing aspects of how not just energy extraction works, not just how energy generation works, but how capital works and capital's relationship to politics in our society. But in the short term, yeah, sometimes people are going to have to get in front of some fucking bulldozers. You know, it is worth noting that I think that there's a decent chance, obviously, the violence in Standing Rock happened under Obama. There was some evidence that they were pulling back from forcing the pipeline forward when Trump got elected, and he definitely forced it through. It's impossible to say if it would have happened or not under President Clinton. I think we would have had a better chance of actually stopping the pipeline. I don't think she was particularly gave a shit about whether or not the pipeline happened. But in general, Democrats, when you yell at them, and you're on the left or the right, are a little bit, you know, they're wusses. So like you can get them to do shit.
You can shame them into action if nothing else.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all we do is like shame our local politicians, and they seem to have like no reserves of shame whatsoever. They're just all, you know, so in the drink.
That's the thing, is that like, I think as far as elections go, like, it would be great if we had a candidate for any office. It's like, yay, we love this person, but it's much more like useful and probably possible to have somebody that you can just like berate into.
No, yeah. And I have felt like very heartened by the amounts of people that have been turning out for all kinds of things to protect the more vulnerable people. You know, I have seen people stand in front of some bulldozers to keep homeless encampments from being razed, and it feels like everybody is paying attention to, you know, to the way that the cops have always treated unhoused people in LA is how they are treating everybody now.
Right.
And people are seeing how they are.
Yeah.
When you are confronting fascism, the only remedy to force is force. Now, that doesn't mean you have to violently attack them, but putting your body in front of a bulldozer is a type of force that is exerting force in the real world, just like confronting a riot line. Even if your plan is not to physically harm those officers, it's to stand arm in arm and make them beat you. You are exerting force in the world, and force is the only language fascism understands.
For sure.
Way or the other, that's the only thing that gets us out of this. You know, maybe it is the force of keeping enough people out in the streets long enough for months that we scare them back into their little holes and we win a democratic election and we start to dismantle some of the structures that allowed things to get this bad in the first place. Maybe that's the solution, but it starts where it already is right now with this uprising, which is people exerting their force as a mass in the street.
Because there are more of us than there are of them.
Yeah.
Right, Robert?
Also just like,
please say yes.
Please say yes.
Yeah. We're scared, Robert.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, I haven't, this is the most optimistic I've been about our chances to win in a long time, actually. Because it does seem like a lot of people are finally getting it in a way that they haven't, that like,
yeah.
Oh, shit's completely fucked. And like, I have to go kind of risk my life a bit to unfuck it, right? There's a great, you know, quote from my favorite problematic white man, Hunter Thompson. In democracy, you have to be a player. And that if we want a democracy, we have to play. And that playing isn't voting. Playing is using force. The kind of force, you know, nonviolent force I advocate, but force. And that is what we have to be doing.
For sure. And I think the force of a big group of people showing up places is very powerful.
Yes.
And again, you know, when the people I was with stopped the bulldozer, they all like sat in front of it peacefully. And I think people were just as confused as anything else, you know?
Because doing something like that, even if it's not being outwardly, you're not exerting force on somebody else, you are forcing them to think about their actions in a way that they weren't thinking about them before.
For sure. And it feels like there's like, more people every time at things like that. And people are now just, you know, openly looking for like, how can I be of help? How can I make myself useful?
Well, also, everybody has now been forced to become more familiar with being uncomfortable. And I think after 3 months of really being psychologically uncomfortable in isolation, but also, you know, I mean, really having to consider things like, okay, well, what if my water supply were cut off? Like all of these things that were very figurative are now very pressing.
Because we live in like techno-feudalism. It's like we have the appearance of all this luxury. And then when you strip it away and you see what's really there and people can't go to the doctor if they need to, it's like, oh, maybe everybody having to like sit and think about like how your Starbucks gets made for 3 months is like very useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Robert, before we let you go, do you have any parting words for how people can find you on social media, where, you know, what they can listen to that you make? I know we introduced you at the beginning, but your social handles.
I got a 6-part mini series within Behind the Bastards coming out right now called Behind the Police. You can find it in Behind the Bastards, or you can find it by looking up Behind the Police on whatever podcast app you use. It's a history of the American police, and kind of my argument as to why reform is actually impossible and we need to replace it with something else. But it's history. It's a lot of history that I think particularly a lot of white people, you'd be surprised how many of your black friends know all of this history. But I didn't know a lot of it until I started researching, and I don't think most white people do, and it's important. And check that out, please.
For sure.
Awesome.
I mean, we talked on the first part of the show, we were talking about replacing parts of Disneyland that are racist and whether they are like Confederate monuments and need to be like left
up. Okay, we're finally talking about the teacup ride. Yes, yes.
Thank
Fuck
you.
Those teacups.
Thank you. Yeah. Rude. The teacups, they're vomit machines.
You literally, I'm mad now. Never mind. I was all into like, going to fuck up some police, and now I don't know.
I feel like looking into the history of these things and of American institutions in general is like the most helpful thing anyone can do, is read the history of this country and see how we got here.
Yeah.
Robert, yes. I also wanted to out you as a fall fanatic. I just found out
you are a huge fall stan. Oh my god.
An autumn man?
I fall more than autumn, but I love them both. Real excited for Pumpkin Spice to come back. Hoping we all survive for that.
Oh, yeah. I saw you were a PSL stan. That's
And look, if you live in a small
shocking.
Place, how can people stockpile their Pumpkin Spice if they live in a small apartment?
Yeah.
Just so that they can survive.
I'll actually tell you, because I've thought a lot about this. You don't want to be buying Pumpkin Spice products. You want to buy actual Pumpkin Spice, the spice, because that will allow you.
Is it like a goop?
It's just like
a powder.
There's recipes for making it too, but you want to stockpile the raw pumpkin spice ingredients, and then you can pumpkin spice whatever it is that you need.
It's all just nutmeg.
No, it's a lot of it. It has layers, dude. Thank you so much, Robert, for joining us today, and everyone, please check out Behind the Police.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Robert.
We will see you next week. Thank you so much for listening to the pod this week. If you're enjoying it, we would love a review on iTunes. You can follow us on social media. We are Night Call Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, Night Call Pod on Twitter.
And you should give us a night call if you have any questions about our dystopian reality. Our number is 1-240-46-NIGHT, or you can give us a night email at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. And you can also join us on our Patreon. We are at patreon.com/nightcall, where you can join at a number of different membership levels to get bonus episodes, our newsletter, mixtapes, all sorts of fun stuff. So find us there, patreon.com/nightcall. And we will see you all next week.
Bye.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of 2 clinically studied ingredients in 1 revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com, the lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.